In his new book, The Disaster Profiteers, How Natural Catastrophes Are Making the Rich Richer and Leaving the Poor Even Further Behind, leading geoscientist John Mutter argues that natural disasters and the resulting media frenzy too often allow the wealthy and powerful to benefit while the poor are further disenfranchised. He says we've seen it happen in New Orleans post-Katrina when the city was reshaped and gentrified, making it almost impossible for many of its poorest, mostly black citizens to return. Again, the title of the book is The Disaster Profiteers, and we welcome John Mutter to the roundtable this morning. Thank you very much for being with us. A great pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
What got you on the subject of looking at disaster and how there are those who profit from it?
My original training is on the natural science side of things. I'm a geophysicist, so I study climate and earthquakes and such. But you come to realize after looking at these things for some time that your ability to understand the natural phenomenon doesn't give you much insight into a disaster, which is a social phenomenon, because we measure it in lives lost, people injured, and economic consequences. The physical sciences don't provide you much insight into that. So curious to try to understand better what really makes a disaster, I looked on the through a sort of social lens at the same sort of phenomenon. That's where it came from for me.
Do you, and you point this out in the book, but I'm interested in the commonality between these events of, I guess, how much of it is seen as an opportunity to profit, or that it's almost inherent in its makeup of not being able to handle a disaster?
Yeah, this surprised me more than a little. There's been discussion in the literature about things that happen afterwards, but I thought, well, surely Katrina in New Orleans is going to behave differently from Cyclone Nargis in Myanmar. I mean, in one case, a wealthy country with an advanced democracy, in another case, a not very wealthy country with a military dictatorship. I mean, surely these things would play out differently. And in fact, they're surprisingly similar. And everywhere you look, although there are differences, of course, there is a commonality to this. There's a desire to deny that things are as bad as they really are. There's a desire to seem as if you're in control when you're not, which was certainly true in both Myanmar and in New Orleans, where everything you heard was that, you know, we've got it under control, whereas in fact it wasn't under control at all. And then the overreaction that comes from watching television reports of what turned out to be actually fairly minor examples of looting and other antisocial behavior, which triggers the deployment of military troops into a civilian situation primarily to protect property, not to help people. And those things happen all the time.
You write in the book, you have a chapter entitled Struck Dumb in New Orleans. And you write the disasters in Myanmar and Haiti are similar to those in New York and New Orleans in that each was worse than it should have been. And you say this chapter discusses why they were so bad and who made them that way. Let us talk about New Orleans, and especially with the anniversary of what happened to make it as bad and to allow it to unfold in such a frightening way.
Yeah, well, something that I don't think anybody really predicted in terms of the social changes that have gone on since. But one thing you do have to recognize, and I think you've almost said this, is that the mortality figures for Katrina in New Orleans are outrageous. They're enormous. You have to go back to 1923, to the Lake Okeechobee event, and then back to 1900 to the Galveston flood to get figures that large. Where you're used to seeing big numbers like that is in poor countries. So it was often said that Katrina made us look poor. And in fact, Katrina primarily disadvantaged those who were the poorest in New Orleans society. They're the ones who were displaced, continue to be displaced, and are unable to come back to redevelop where they were in the first place. Occasionally, those people will be better off in the places they've gone to, especially the children who might find themselves in better educational systems. But the adults, by and large, are not better off. They've just gone somewhere else and have been prevented from coming back to where they would like to be, while those who have influence on the government, sort of an elite that goes between the business people and the government, are able to essentially plan a new city that's better for them. And that's what typically happens.
In that chapter, you write that in just a few days, the narrative had changed from criticism of government inaction to one describing a war zone. You write that one example, America is once more plunged into a snake pit of anarchy, death, looting, raping, marauding thugs, suffering infrastructure, a guttered police force, insufficient troop levels, and criminally negligent government planning. With the change in that narrative, what did that allow, especially when it came to the profiteering?
It turned the victims into criminals. It turned them into people who were not worth saving anymore. Because, you know, you're trying to send people in to help others. Then the media portrays those people as criminal. People who are shooting one another, raping babies in the Superdome, which never happened. You know, there's another quote where it talks about bodies piling up in the Superdome. Six people died in the Superdome. One was a suicide. Another four were natural causes, and another one was a drug overdose. Nobody had their throat slit. This was just amplified. So the social distinction between the poor and the wealthy was exaggerated to the point where you shouldn't try to help the poor anymore. They don't need it. They're bad people, they're problems. So it sort of allowed, it gave the excuse to not allow them to return, to take their lands and to reshape the social geography of New Orleans in a way that is better for a certain group of people and not for the displaced people.
So what you say is what happened in New Orleans is best described as elite panic. What
yeah.
is that?
That's when people feel that they have lost control of the situation, where despite saying it's okay, FEMA's doing a great job, in fact, they see that that's not the case. And the only way they can control it is with military. There was an extraordinary number of military personnel sent to New Orleans. In fact, it seems that at the height of the troop deployment into New Orleans, there were more people in uniform than there were civilian people in New Orleans. Yet they were still saying it was out of control.
So how much of this was conscious and how much of this was reactionary?
It is both. There's no question about that. But what is normal is that a group of people will have the ability to take advantage and see the opportunity and simply do it. You know, there are quotes from people in government in New Orleans who were saying, well, you know, we've always wanted to get rid of the project housing. We've always wanted to clean out those neighborhoods. We couldn't do it. Now nature has done it for us. So basically, Katrina achieved a slum clearing, something that people would have liked to have done anyway, but you've taken the opportunity of nature, in a sense, doing it so that you don't have to do it yourself.
You also mentioned about the media coverage, especially the media coverage of the criminal behavior in New Orleans, and you say it had all the hallmarks of pure panic, and you say it, no doubt, caused panic as well. In that, I want you to draw the link to how the profiteering began and how the rich, in this case, as your subtitle indicates, how the rich were able to get richer, and of course, the poor, in many cases, 10 years later, still don't have homes.
Right. And sometimes are being evicted off empty building lots that no longer have their homes on them because they can't prove what they owned. So what happens in most places that I've seen, this sort of media fixation on, you know, if it bleeds, it leads, right? If it looks dramatic, you focus on it, gives the impression that it's rampant, right? You see one or two examples of looting, and it certainly did happen, but you don't show examples of people not looting. You don't show pro-social behavior because it's nowhere near as interesting as antisocial behavior. And antisocial behavior is conducted by people who you can think of as criminals. So you have a perfect right to suppress them, take their property, redesign things in a way that's better for the elite in the first place, and hence they are able to exacerbate the gap that already existed between the rich and the poor. This doesn't happen in more equal societies where there's not such a large difference in the first place between a wealthy elite and a large population of poor people.
You interestingly portray in New Orleans that there was almost a sense of, because of the racial tensions in the area and in the city, that what we saw in some ways was an act of revenge.
Yeah, there are quotes, and this is not just New Orleans, of people who feel that, rightly or wrongly, that they are a suppressed group, and they take advantage to sort of get back at the oppressors. And you do see that commonly, and people will say, you know, these storekeepers have been robbing us for years, you know, overcharging in effect. Now it's my turn to get even.
You point out toward the end of the book that disaster seen as an opportunity for engineering social change is not a new idea. As you just mentioned, this goes back for 100 years, if not more. So what is it that do you believe that can be done to alter that? Because let's just use New Orleans as an example on this anniversary, that 10 years later, it doesn't seem like we've learned a ton of lessons from that experience.
No, we're not very good at learning from... We tend to put these bad things behind us and, you know, feel and act like they're never going to happen again. We like to think that they're anomalous and hence are not going to be repeated. We really need to pay more attention to what happens after the media's gone away, after it doesn't look as interesting anymore, when people are bored with endless pictures of broken glass and roofs off houses, and ensure that there is, you know, justice for everybody who was harmed. It's clear that, of course, the wind blew just as hard on the houses of the rich and the poor, and in the lower ninth and Lakeview is a wealthy community, the lower ninth is very poor, the depth of floodwaters was about the same. Much of the lower ninth has not recovered at all. If you look at the repopulation rates, the repopulation rate in Lakeview is about double the repopulation rate in the lower ninth. Mm. So it's what happens afterwards that is critical, and it will set up the conditions for the next one. In that way, it's much like peace building after a conflict. If you don't build the peace correctly, you're likely to sow the seeds of the next conflict rather than mitigate the prospect of a new conflict.
At some point in that process, why isn't there a feeling of shame, that we are ashamed of what happened and what was allowed to happen?
The Economist's front page reporting on Katrina had a picture of a black woman crying into a camera with a T-shirt that said New Orleans on it, just written on it, and the title said, The Shaming of America. And they were dead right. This was just scandalous. It should never have happened, particularly in 2005 in a wealthy democracy. It's scandalously bad what happened in New Orleans. And those who should be ashamed don't seem to be ashamed.
You point out in the book, and I was really glad to see it, that Michael Eric Dyson, who is a scholar of race and has written this book, Come Hell or High Water, and you say that this book came out a year after the hurricane, but he pretty much nailed what happened. And when you look back at it now, he was dead right.
A couple of facts were not quite right, but they were minor. Yes, he understood what New Orleans was like before the storm came. He understood the racial tensions. For a lot of people in this country, it was a revelation to see, you know, every face in the Superdome was black. You know, maybe that's not completely true, but most of them. And then, we got to know about the Lower Ninth. We got to know about Treme. You know, places that we didn't know the names of before are now part of our language, you know. But Dyson knew that already. So he could predict the social consequences pretty well. And, yeah, he was right. And I think he was the first book. And I'm glad it was the first book.
So with your book and looking at this about nature and human nature and justice and how all of this plays into a disaster, where does your optimism lie if you are optimistic at all?
I am. I think things change when you point them out. You know, even though a lot of people are going to read this and say, well, I know all of that. You know, this is true. But I think most people that I've spoken to, like people in your position, have found at least some of it revelatory. Like, really, is this what happens? And as soon as you acknowledge that that's what happens, then you can make policy to change it. And I think in most democracies, it's really about proper oversight of the reconstruction process that happens afterwards. I'm less optimistic about less democratic places where there's a central rule and they don't pay much attention to the press and can control the web, etc.
We've been talking a lot this morning about Hurricane Katrina, but obviously your book is about disaster in many different forms, in earthquakes and storms and volcanic eruptions. And I guess there is, even though those events are very different, there is a commonality on how we react to them.
Yeah, there's a commonality of a sort of denial to begin with, a sort of initial flat-footed response when you don't quite know what to do. And then usually an overreaction to stories of antisocial behavior, and it doesn't seem to matter You know, Haiti was an earthquake, right? But, you know, there's plenty of stories of rape and looting, which did happen, but not to the extent that was reported. And the stories read from Chile to Haiti to New Orleans. The narrative is the narrative that we want to use to describe the same things everywhere.
John Mutter is a professor at Columbia University with appointments in the Department of Earth and Environmental Sciences and in International and Public Affairs. His new book is The Disaster Profiteers, How Natural Catastrophes Are Making the Rich Richer and Leaving the Poor Even Further Behind. The book is published by St. Martin's Press. John, thank you very much for sharing with us this morning. I appreciate your expertise.
Oh, you're very, very welcome. Thank you.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, the title of the book, The Disaster Profiteers by John Mutter. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.